Kevin O'Connor Show is coming up next. Welcome back to another episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show. I've got a great guest that I'm really excited about today. Jason Timpf from Hoops Tonight. He hosts that show over on YouTube with The Volume. One of the best people covering the NBA. Jason, super smart, brings great insight. Love Jason's stuff. Everything he does on social media with his game analysis as well, his breakdowns that he posts over on X. Jason's great. And we talked a lot about a lot of different teams today. I shared with him my seven thoughts from this NBA weekend with the games that we haven't talked about since the last show. And then we talked about the NBA Cup. We talked about Cooper Flagg, hit a whole bunch of topics. Here's my conversation with Jason coming up after Father John Misty. Here with Jason Timpf from Hoops Tonight with Volume Sports. Jason, here are seven of my thoughts from the NBA this weekend. First of all, the Miami Heat, they're coming alive, man. They've had wins against the Lakers, Suns, and Cavaliers, and Tyler Hero continues to pass every single test. He was incredible against the Cavaliers on Sunday, sliced through their defense, left foot, left hand finishes. The Bam Adebayo, Tyler Hero pick and roll continues to be one of the best in the entire NBA. What have you seen from the leap Tyler Hero has made this season for the Heat, and how has it affected his team?
The other big thing that stood out to me is early on his career, in the large sample, he wasn't as efficient as he needed to be as a pull-up jump shooter. He's been the best pull-up jump shooter in the league this year. Just much, much more efficient coming off the dribble in those situations and knocking down shots. That's just such a huge boost to his efficiency in those situations. It's kind of similar to what we saw with Jason Tatum earlier in his career. Now that he's hitting all those pull-up jump shots, it's unlocking everything for him. But obviously for a team that desperately needs offense, and thankfully Jimmy's been joining them at this level since he came back, I think that has just brought them those two reliable offensive creators that they needed to be a serious team.
For sure. And with Hero, look, Butler, the talk before the season was that he's gonna, you know, be in playoff mode all season long, and that hasn't necessarily happened. It's been one of the reasons why the Heat have been a bit up and down this season. But as that's been happening, Hero has been their leading scorer. He's averaging 24 points per game. He's averaging 5.4 assists per game. And the big thing with him, you mentioned the improved jump shooting, it's a change in habit for Tyler Hero. He's averaging a career high shots at the rim, 16.2%, a career high percent of shots from beyond the arc at 56.9%. And that's because he has completely, basically eliminated the deep mid-range shot from his diet, a career low. 8.4% of his shots have come from the mid-range. So he's cut that out from much higher averages, over 20% earlier in his career, 22.7% previously in his career. So he's cut that by a third. He's playmaking more often, taking more threes, getting to the rim more often. It goes to show, you know, Heat fans were on my ass today on social media because of my take at the time of the Damian Lillard trade. I said the Blazers made the right decision. Tyler Hero could not have been flipped for what they ended up doing in the deal. Maybe that was true at the time, but it wouldn't be true today with the way in which Hero's improved. He has significantly improved from the time of those Dame talks, and it's gotten to the point that I'm feeling like maybe Miami lucked out and not getting Dame, because they have Hero emerging as a star now, Jason, and they still have all those other assets that they would have had to given up with him. So Miami suddenly is in a very, very, very interesting position because of Hero's player development.
It's always funny how the internet will, when things change, when the material information changes, your take is supposed to withstand that, right, Kevin? That's how it's supposed to work.
And it's fine. I mean, they were on me at the time, too. Like, to the Heat fans' credit, they were on my ass then as well. So they're consistent, and I respect it, and I appreciate their passion. I'm not complaining about that, but it is just, it does put into perspective to me to see that post from over a year ago now, just to see how much better Hero has gotten in a year because he's gotten stronger, because he's changed his habits with his shot diet. And dude, the playmaking from him, it's just on another level. He's become their point guard.
Yeah, and it started to fly. I was really impressed with him in the playoffs last year with the degree of difficulty that he had at some of the higher level reads he was making in ball screens. And like, again, when you're that much of a threat as a scorer, it starts to open those things up. And he's got the height and the athleticism to make the cross-court passes and things along those lines. I've been really impressed with him to start this year, too.
He's been excellent. Onto my second thought from the weekend, Joel Embiid looked the best that he has this entire season with his return on Sunday. He had 31 points, 12 rebounds, moved better than he has before. We've just seen the Bucks climb back over 500, and now quietly, you know, Sixers still below 500, but they're 1.5 games behind from the play-in, 5 games back from the 5 seed, which is currently Miami. They've won 4 out of 5 games now, Jason. Do you feel like the Sixers have turned a bit of a corner here?
Well, it's coming together at the right time. I think part of the thing that's really helped too is you saw in that second quarter stretch there when they were spamming that ball screen where Tyrese was just repeatedly feeding Embiid right at the elbow. I kind of like the layout where the two of them are the focal point and Paul George more functions as like an off-ball scorer, essentially as like the juiced up Michael Porter Jr. for the team. But they just have all of this shooting surrounding the two of them, and like obviously it's a little bit tougher when you get into some different matchups. Him going against Vucevic one-on-one kind of looks like a player going against his coach in the pregame warm-up sometimes. but I think, again, this is the beauty of the Eastern Conference. Like in the Eastern Conference, it's never too dark. You just have a couple of good weeks and you can make a substantial improvement in your situation in the standings. Again, it's going to require a lot. And like, I think the biggest thing is just them all getting lots of reps together, which is going to require them staying on the floor healthy together for a long time, which hasn't been the case. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend like it's over for this team, because it's just not, just like it wasn't over for the Bucks earlier this year.
For sure. I mean, you're right. This is the benefit of the East, and coming up, they have Indiana, Charlotte twice, then Cleveland, then San Antonio, entering that Boston game on Christmas Day. So of these next 5 games, if they go 3-2 and they're entering Christmas 10-17, that's kind of a win. Considering Embiid's health this year, and like you're right in the play-in in the Eastern Conference with that group. And I mean, look, Embiid talked after the game and he's like, it's been depressing having to deal with all this and all that. But he looked better, I felt like, on Sunday. And like you said, I know it's against Vooch, but physically I felt like he looked like he was moving a bit better. Did you see the same thing as me?
No, for sure. There was an early move he had in that game, a little left shoulder fade where he threw a hard shoulder fake towards the baseline. And for a guy with his big frame to snatch it back going the opposite the way he did and leave Vooch in the dust. The other dead giveaway where you can really tell when Embiid's feeling good with his body, he gets into these dramatic hesitation pull-ups where like he'll drop that shoulder and he'll look like he's going to drive and then he'll just rise up into that 15 footer. And he just looked spry. He looked like he was moving it. And for the record, that's more important. We're not advocating for guys out here to play through injuries. We're advocating for you to do what it takes to get healthy and then stay in shape and stay on the floor as much as you can. The criticism for Embiid has been the process before getting to the court. We're not trying to get him to play through injuries. He just needs to do what it takes to get his body right so that he can be out there.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. And obviously, we're talking about a guy who's had a lot of injuries in his career as well. Injuries are part of the deal with him. You almost expect him to miss time, which is why getting Paul George was so important, and why I think even ahead of Embiid coming back on Sunday and looking pretty good, it was encouraging that we finally got to see Maxey and George for an extended time, and McCain with his blossoming we've seen through the first, you know, stretch of his career. The team looked like they could at least stay afloat without Joel Embiid, and that was the whole thing entering the season, where it's like, oh yeah, Embiid not going to play back-to-backs. At least the Sixers can be competent in those situations, unlike last year, because of Paul George, because of Maxey. So we saw a little glimpse of that. So I'm becoming more optimistic about the Sixers. Granted, they're still not on the level of the Celtics or the top teams in the Eastern Conference. My third thought from the weekend, Jason, Brandon Miller, my guy. Brandon Miller is taking a leap. His last 11 games, 27.5 points, 6 rebounds, 3.2 assists, 41% from 3, and 66% at the rim. And that's the big thing to me, because we saw him over the weekend spin on OG Anunoby, dunk on the Knicks, and then on Sunday against the Pacers, late in the game, split the Pacers defense in a pick and roll, had a massive dunk in the paint, and that was during a stretch where Charlotte just closed out Indiana. Brandon Miller scored or assisted on the final 12 of 13 points for the Hornets. I thought he displayed patience, control, tough shot-making ability, and that skill level has improved getting to the basket as well. Brandon Miller, taking a leap.
that left to right crossover that he hit Halliburton with on that hedge for the dunk, that that move for him, he goes to it a lot, and it's one of the nastiest left to right crossovers in the league because he sits in that high hesitation like he's about to shoot, and then he can quickly cover ground back to the right and get downhill. And I'm glad you mentioned the rim finishing because that was kind of an issue in the early part of the season, but he's been doing a lot better there. A big part of it too is 3-point volume. He's attempting 14 threes per game over his last five games and shooting really well off the catch. And again, we talked about that a little bit earlier with Tyler Herro, but you can do a lot for yourself by taking the right kinds of shots, and he's shooting it so well off the catch. He's got a bunch of like pretty advanced scoring moves too. Like I saw him hit like a slowdown where he does the slowdown steps at the basket in a game against the Knicks a few games ago. He's got like a really nice fadeaway over both shoulders. He's got a good floater, just a lot of really high level scoring ability. Really the only thing for me is like he's another one of those guys where the shot hasn't really connected off the dribble yet. If he can get that going, and if he can improve his rim finishing on non-dunks, I think that'll go a long way to getting him to the next level. But I was high on him out of the draft. I had him over Scoot. Did you have him over Scoot? I can't remember.
I did have him over Scoot as well. Yes.
Mm.
That's looking good for the both of us then, huh, Jason?
Yeah. Yeah, I think part of it too is like, I think we're just seeing so much of this where the ability to score over the top of defenses becomes so important when you run into higher level defenses down the line. And I just saw him as a guy that could consistently get to his spots and at least be an option in those situations. And it's something that's bared out to this point.
Yeah. I mean, look, my argument at the time in the draft was you're talking about a guy who's 6'9", who has great shot making ability from the perimeter, who showed improvement getting to the rim, defensive versatility, and just an MF-er attitude on the floor. No fear, never scared. Versus Scoot, who's a 6'1" guard, a very good athlete, but not an elite athlete, not a Derrick Rose athlete as he was hyped as, with a questionable shot. And so I just felt like Miller was the higher upside and the higher floor pick. Now Scoot, he's shown flashes, maybe he'll still pan out, but Brandon Miller, I think everything we've seen from him, he has the ability to play next to other stars when LaMelo's out there. As you said, a knockdown guy off the catch, 14 threes per game, well over 40%, and can hit him from deep as well. Off the dribble, he goes through spurts where he is draining everything. He shot over 45% from mid-range last year. Right now, he's around 28, 29% from three off the dribble, low 30% from mid-range off the dribble. I expect that number to go up. He had a big pull-up late in the game against the Pacers on Sunday. I think we're going to see more of that success as the season continues, like we did last year in Charlotte. I just think he's a three-level scorer. And you mentioned that left-to-right crossover when he split that pick and roll. If his handle keeps tightening over the years to come, as it has going back to Bama his freshman year, the dude, there will be no answers for him because his ability to shoot over the top and his blossoming ability to get to the basket. To me, that LaMelo Ball, Brandon Miller core, that is something that could become one of the most unstoppable duos in the NBA. I just hope, we talk about health all the time. LaMelo's missed a lot of time too. He's out again right now. I feel like some of these cores, we aren't seeing these guys for a sustained period of time. You need to develop chemistry too.
No, absolutely. And like you even see how Brandon Miller's scoring has taken off since LaMelo went down. And it's like, one of the things with Brandon, the last thing I'll say about it too, so many of these like lanky scoring wings don't have the quickest first step in the world. He's pretty quick off of that first move too. And because like the problem with those tall, skinny wings is you get a good physical defender on them. And unless they really break you off, they can get their hands on him and kind of corral him. He's got the quickness to get around a lot of guys, which I think is a difference between him and some of the other like bigger, lanky scoring wings that we've seen come through the league.
My fourth thought from the weekend, it's about to get really, really ugly for the Pacers. They've lost 5 out of 6 games, Jason, to Detroit, Toronto, Brooklyn, Charlotte. And then coming up, this is their list of opponents to close 2024. They got the Sixers, Pelicans, Suns, Kings, Warriors, Thunder, Celtics, Bucks. So they have a couple potential winnable ones in there, but for a team right now, they're 10-15. They are the 9 seed currently in the Eastern Conference. We're talking about the Sixers moving up. Some of these teams are scrappy behind them right now. the Pacers are entering a stretch here where I think it's about to get really ugly entering 2025.
Yeah, Tyrese Haliburton looks like a player who isn't just not playing well, but has also lost some of his edge, like some of his confidence and his like mojo, whatever you want to call it. There was a play at the end of the Hornets game where he came off of a ball screen and he almost looked surprised that the dude was up at the level. And I've seen that about a half dozen times this year where he's just not seeing the floor as well as he usually does. He's not processing things as quickly as he usually does. This is actually a crazy stat. When Tyrese scores at least 15 points, the Pacers are 10-8. When he fails to score 15 points, they're 0-7.
Wow.
Which the craziest part of that is like he's had seven games this year where he hasn't even gotten to 15 points. They're 19th in offense. This was a team that posted a 124 offensive rating in the first part of last year before he got hurt. Their pick and rolls are down 7 points per 100 possessions from where they were last year. And when you combine that with them being a bottom 10 defense and Haliburton, again, at that Pacers game, you talked about Brandon Miller splitting him on that guard ball screen. He also had that weird gamble in the passing lane just on a swing pass that led to a bucket for Charlotte in crunch time. Like he's just hurting them on both ends right now. It's really difficult to overcome.
It's so depressing from an Indiana standpoint. If you're a Pacers fan right now, you're feeling good after last season. You make the East Finals. You had traded for Pascal Siakam. You're like, entering a summer, Haliburton can get healthy, build chemistry with Pascal Siakam. Maybe the young guys get better. Guess what? They have. Mathurin has improved. Jairus Walker is one of the silver linings off their bench. He's had some good moments. The team has improved around Haliburton, but Haliburton himself is just nowhere close to the magic that we saw in the first half of last season. It really does go to show how tough team building really is, because Halliburton's the guy you expected to get even better from this. But it's hard to feel much confidence in that. Because you mentioned the mojo might be gone. I had said on this podcast about a month ago that it seems like the back issue that had bothered him in the playoffs could be one of the reasons for his issues now. I know people on social media have talked about the home and road splits, how he's been much better at home than he has been on the road. Maybe from traveling, the back flares up. Who knows? It's hard to know. But I think you're right, though. It's not just physical. It's not just the way he's being defended. There's like a mojo that's gone with him right now. And that's what makes it so depressing when everything else around him, I feel like, has gotten better.
They're not even playing as fast as they did last year. It's the craziest thing. It literally looks like a team that is a shell of itself, even though it's, like you said, the same guys and a lot of improvement around the roster. And so you'd think like, oh, maybe he just needs a few good games, but he just had a few good games. And then you talk about the home road splits. That was a stinker at home against the Hornets yesterday. So like it just, yeah, I will say that has been the turnaround between where the Pacers were last year to this year, even with the crazy high of the conference finals run last year, has been one of the more bizarre things I've seen in the NBA in recent years. Like I just don't know how to explain it. There was a time there where I was like, maybe it's the soft tissue thing. Cause I think about like, you know, how Devin Booker hurt his hammy and he just hasn't quite been able to like maintain the level he was at earlier. James Harden, Tyrese Haliburton. I was wondering if maybe that's what it was, but your guess is as good as mine, Kevin.
Well, the Pacers currently have the 8th worst record in the NBA, which gives them about a 20% chance of getting the number one pick for Cooper Flagg. So we're going to take a quick break and when we're back, we're going to talk about Capture the Flag. All right, Jason, I mentioned Cooper Flagg. He had a big game for Duke over the weekend once again with 20 points, 12 rebounds, and 3 stocks, 1 assist on Sunday. That follows up a game last week when he had 22 points, 11 boards, 5 stocks, 4 assists against number 2 Auburn. I talked about Cooper Flagg with Tate Frazier on this podcast a few weeks ago about whether anybody could really push him to take the number one spot. I think right now Flagg is clearly the number one. I don't have anybody else in the same tier currently. But I'm curious about your perspective when you watch Cooper Flagg. Do you see him as one of those clear-cut number one prospects in a draft class? So with what you've seen so far this season.
I do. I think there's a lot of hand-wringing about little things like some of the scoring production when people, I don't think, realize just how difficult it is to put up giant point totals, especially in a team context when you're playing at the Power 5 level, that sort of thing. And then some of the complaints about his jump shooting. He's 17, and I think he's going to be fine in the long run, at least fine enough. The big thing that stands out to me is he doesn't seem to have any trouble getting to his spots. Like we talked about it earlier with Brandon Miller, at 6'10", he's pretty quick. His start-stop quickness is there. It almost feels like he's playing downhill. Like, it feels like he just has got this, like, burst. And the pivoting over both shoulders, the ability to, like, elevate and hold the ball in two hands and disguise where he's going to finish from, depending on where the rim protector goes. We haven't even gotten to the intangible stuff. Like, to me, I think his competitive nature and just the way he's wired as a human being is, like, the kind of thing that every franchise should be scrambling for. I'm like completely sold on him. I understand that there's going to be some growing pains. He's 17 years old. It's going to take some time. There's going to be some stinkers in there, but to me, he looks like a guy who can get to wherever he wants to on the floor, who's got a ton of room for skill improvement in the long run and is wired the right way. So you can't go wrong with him.
I think that's spot on. I mean, that is really my fifth thought from the weekend, is that Cooper Flagg continues to prove he's the clear-cut number one pick. That's the way I feel about it. I think it was the Auburn game last Wednesday. You mentioned the intangible factor, like the hustle. It's also his awareness. Like, for a 17-year-old, his defensive awareness, he had this great help rotation late in the game against Auburn where – I mean, like, he's 6'9", 6'10". He looks like Draymond Green helping at the basket. And then he grabs the rebound and he dribbles up the floor himself and he makes this cross-court pass to the left corner from the right side of the floor. And it's just pinpoint pass. His teammate bricked the three. But it's like just one of these sequences where you're like, okay, elite rim protection as a help defender, elite pass in transition, bring the ball up himself. And this is a guy who's going to be a connective star. If the skill level as a shooter develops over time, you're talking about a dude that's going to be one of the best players in the league. And if it doesn't, you're still talking about a guy that makes a winning impact in virtually every single category on the floor and can still get buckets. I mean, he's leading Duke in points. He's averaging over 20 at age 17. He's still scoring late in games, even without a reliable jumper. If that comes along, like, it's a wrap. He's going to be one of the best players in the league. And if it doesn't, he's still going to impact winning. That's the way I feel with Cooper Flagg. Like, there's a high floor with this dude and a high ceiling. You can't say that about anybody else in this year's draft class to the level you can with Cooper Flagg.
He also plays with strength in a way that I think will be leveraged even more when he gets into NBA strength and conditioning for a few years. Like, he doesn't get bumped off his spot super easily. He fights for position. He brings physical aggression to every confrontation, whether it's a box out or like just a dude fighting for post position. Like, I think he's got a nasty streak. I think he's going to be really good right away.
On that point, Jason, is there a player he reminds you of, past or present? Do you have a comp for him?
Oh my gosh. You know, there were a couple of, this is a bad comp because I think he's a little quicker, but like there were some possessions where it reminded me a little bit of Paolo and his ability to kind of like feel the defender's body and pivot the right way to kind of turn over a different shoulder. And just kind of a little bit of that like downhill power spin game reminded me a little bit of Paolo. But you know how it is. I like with those comps, it's always like a smorgasbord of like six different players that turns into who the guy is.
Mm. I mean, I think that's one of them that belongs in the bunch. It's like, for me, I have a list of Pascal Siakam, later career Blake Griffin, Andre Kirilenko, Scottie Pippen. Like, there's like a big mix of guys you can put together that kind of sort of work for Cooper Flagg. But I can't think of just like one clear-cut name for him. He's a big mix of players.
The Blake Griffin one is interesting to me because he's another guy that like kind of, it almost seemed like the floor was tilted towards the basket when he was making, like, it almost feels like he's leaning towards the rim all the time and just everything is attack, attack, attack.
I mean, people forget, like, even when Blake Griffin was like a 100th percentile athlete in his prime, but even late career Blake Griffin with the Pistons, like, he's a damn good player, man. I love that version of Blake Griffin. So, like, there's a little bit of that in Cooper when I watch him. My sixth thought from the weekend, the Brandon Ingram injury is actually a good thing for the Pelicans. He's out indefinitely with a severely sprained right ankle. I know there's talk about them trading him or extending him. I think it's a good thing because we're going to see a hell of a lot more Trey Murphy. We're going to see more Herb Jones. We're going to see more guys off their bench. We might get more touches for Jordan Hawkins. To me, this Pelicans team, which stinks, that's tanking, it's one of the three worst teams in the league right now. You're going to see more of the guys who actually have a future with this franchise. So for Pelicans fans, I know it might get even uglier without Brandon Ingram out there, but to me, this is a good long-term thing for the team.
I agree. I've always viewed the long-term vision of this team as more of a driving kick team, somebody closer to Boston than like the methodical pick and roll brand. Because Brandon Ingram, I actually think is kind of underrated a little bit. Like I think when he's in rhythm and he's healthy for an extended stretch and he can really operate with the ball in his hands, I think he's actually one of the better passing forwards in the league. Obviously, he can get into rhythm as a scorer at all three levels. I just don't think it's the right fit for him there, because there, I think this team is at its best when it's dribble penetration off of Zion and a bunch of dudes like Trey Murphy, like Jordan Hawkins, like Herb Jones, like you talked about, guys that can knock down shots and drive closeouts and then essentially become an advantage creation, advantage extending, like take a bunch of catch and shoot threes, a bunch of stuff at the rim. That's the way I see the team in the long run. And then in addition to that, when you think about Zion, a lot of times people think about partnering with a rim protector, and that ended up being another huge part of the center approach this season. Like, oh, well, let's try this, let's try that, let's try putting a big who can shoot next to him. And really, I think the best thing you can do to anchor Zion is surround him with elite perimeter defenders, guys that can really contain the ball and switch so that you keep him out of situations where he needs to be really active on the back line defensively, where he can be lost sometimes. So like, I think
I would love to think about the team building around Zion, but like, we don't even see him on the floor, dude. Like, we just don't. I would love to think about team building around Zion, but where is he? We never see him.
He's eventually going to come back, right?
How long?
You want to know the last time I saw him, Kevin? I was scrolling through Twitter and I was like, I know that dude. Who is that? Oh, wait, it's this guy named Anthony who does tattoos here in Tucson. The guy he did an episode of Inked. He just did Zion's back tattoo. And I'm like, oh, this is the most I'm seeing of Zion, is seeing a buddy of mine give him a tattoo. That's probably not a good sign.
Did you see, I think it was on Pat McAfee's show, Sham Sharania made an appearance there. And he said, the Pelicans aren't going to waive Zion Williamson. Like, he was talking about it in the context of like, there's ways for them to waive him and get out of the deal. And it was just like, this is where we are with him. Like, even the word waive being used in some hypothetical discussion, this is where we are. I mean, dude,
it's depressing. Like,
what a bummer.
It's depressing after I literally watched LeBron and AD just not be able to guard him in a play-in game last year.
I know. Such a bummer. My seventh thought from the weekend, I'm still confused about the Nuggets, Jason. And I want to ask you about them, because you picked them to win the West ahead of the season. And I've had my questions about them. Last week, I ranted on this podcast about Jamal Murray being the number one guy to blame with his lack of improvement since they won a title. They are 12-10 on the season. They had a horrible loss to the Wizards. Then they beat the Hawks by 30. Jokic, over these two games, had 104 points in those games combined. What do you make of Denver? Do you still have any confidence in them as a team to win the West? Do you give them any chance, or are you out on that thought that you had before the season at this point?
So after how bad Jamal was getting shut down in the second half of game 7 against Minnesota, and just in general, really uneven series and really an uneven playoff run. Like, it was the high highs, but super low lows. After that, and after he was bad with Canada, I was expecting him to come into the season kind of motivated, maybe with a chip on his shoulder a little bit. And me, I too did pick the Nuggets to win the West to start the season. I have them third now. Both Oklahoma City and Dallas, to me, are teams that I view as bigger threats to get out of the conference at this
still
point.
Still third, though. Third is above Houston. It's above Golden State. It's above Phoenix. Memphis, that's a lot. Memphis, a lot of competitive teams, right? That's still high.
Yeah, and part of the reason, this is my case for that. First of all, every team in the West has big problems other than OKC, really. And even then, they have health problems at this point. But like, every team in the West has problems. So like, I think it can get a little tricky when people like really focus in on specific flaws with certain teams, as if like the Lakers don't have huge problems, as if the Suns don't have huge problems, as if Memphis doesn't have execution issues at the end of games, as if all these teams have problems. And to me, like, a certain amount of this, they're going to be in the 3-6 range because I think they're good enough to float in the regular season. Russ, do I have concerns about him in the playoffs? Absolutely. Do I have concerns about him in the large sample? Absolutely. But there is a lot of good that he's bringing. This thing where like Jamal is just not a threat coming off screens anymore, so that it's not generating any openings for Jokic in the short role, and now Russ is getting him those openings again. This is crazy. Jokic didn't have a single game before this weekend with 10 points scored on roll man possessions. And then Russ got him 27 in two games.
Wow.
Because like all these just spoon fed easy opportunities in the short roll.
Jason, did you say he didn't have one?
Didn't have a single game with 10 points on roll man possessions until this weekend when he had 27 in the two games. And like literally just Russ just coming downhill. Like I'm seeing teams try to catch Russ as he's coming off to try to stop him from getting ahead of steam. Because once he gets ahead of steam, it can be a problem. And so like it just is allowing them to have between that and then Peyton Watson and Christian Brown and just the waves of athleticism. I actually think Christian Brown, them making that calculation to let KCP go and have Christian Brown fill that slot. I actually think that was a worthwhile gamble on their part, and it seems to have paid off. It's going to be up and down. There are going to be a lot of nights where the young guys struggle and they lose the game they shouldn't. Like that Wizards game is probably the worst loss of any team this year. Like to get that much from Jokic on the road against a 2-win team and you lose. But that said, like I think they've got a high enough floor to just kind of stay afloat over the course of the regular season. And then like Nikola Jokic to me is, I was thinking about this on my show today. I'm actually going to put you on the spot, Kevin. I'm a big LeBron guy, and I think you're a LeBron fan too, if I remember correctly.
Don't take LeBron for granted.
I don't remember ever seeing a basketball player make it look this easy on offense. I just don't. No. And I'm just trying to be honest. And LeBron was really damn good on offense at the height of his powers. I don't remember it being like this.
No. I mean, I think Jokic, this is why it's so disappointing that the team is in this state right now, why Murray hasn't improved. Because Jokic has, you know, top five GOAT potential. Like he could enter that threshold of historic stars if he wins more titles. If he ends up with one, I mean, he'll be top 15-ish all time, but you got to win more championships to be top 3, top 4, top 5 all time historically. And so I think when you talk about Jokic, the offensive dominance, the defensive improvement by him over the years by getting in his peak condition, it's pretty remarkable what he's turned himself into. And I think for him to have 56 points on Friday, it was, and then 48 the other night, the dude can do that when he needs to. And it makes me, what your point about how easy he makes it look, it makes me think about what Harrison Wind over at DNVR, a great Nuggets reporter, he posted this on X over the weekend. He's like, Jokic used to have these protest games where he would take no shots. he's like, this felt like the opposite, where it's like all he did was shoot. This was after the game against the Wizards. He's like, I don't feel like he trusted his teammates. All he did is shoot because he knew he had to do everything. So I thought Harrison made a really great point there, because it has gotten to the point where it is the opposite for Jokic. He used to protest with zero shot games, being maximum level selfless, quote unquote selfless. And in this game, now it's like, I have to be the one who scores. I'm not going to look to pass in the way that I can or need to for this team to reach its peak, because this is where they are right now. They need Jokic to do this. And he's showing that he can do this. And I wonder if he's going to have to keep doing it, Jason, for the Nuggets to keep getting wins. Do you feel like it's at this point with Murray out right now, with other guys underwhelming, with the team really not shooting the ball well aside from him, does Jokic need to keep scoring 35-plus points per game for the Nuggets to be that number three team in the West as you have them right now?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, it's interesting. I was pulling numbers because it's like, is I think last night was the third time in the last four games he's gone for at least 35. And over that span, I can't remember the exact number, but he's averaging something insane, like 29 field goal attempts per game. So like the usage is just sky high. A big one that he's been bringing out is like there's been so much talk about the jump shot, which obviously is way better than it was last year. And obviously that helps in pick and pops and in spot up situations and him being able to drive closeouts, which is such a huge part of his game. But another big part of it is he's starting to hit like the face up jump shot where he like comes off of a little curl around the elbow or just catches there for an ISO and he just kind of sits there and leans and jabs and then just kind of leans back and shoots.
So awesome.
Like he's got that one going. And that one, it looks like such an easy breezy little flip of the wrist that it feels like he can do it without much work. And that
not
really
even breaking a sweat at all, Jason. It's crazy.
I know. That to me is the thing that really sets him apart is like you talk, it's like, yeah, he's going to need to do this, but it's like he's so big and he plays such a groundbound, like, physical leverage style of play where he always feels like he's playing balanced on 2 feet that it just doesn't look like it's that difficult for him. And maybe it is, and you and I are making light of it, but like it just seems like he's just cruising through this and it's not too difficult for him to just leverage certain parts of his game to cover for roster deficiencies until they get filled.
I mean, to me, this still comes down to Jamal Murray. He historically has gotten better over the course of seasons. He has been a slow starter. He gets better in the second half of years. This year, he's starting at a lower point than he has in some of those past seasons. Can he get back to the level that he was prior? Can he even get better from his prior levels? To me, that's one of the biggest questions in the entire NBA, and it is definitely the biggest question in the NBA for the Denver Nuggets. You clearly have some level of belief, though, in Murray to get back, though, to have them at number 3 in the West, right?
Just to get enough. My thing is, with Jokic playing this well, they just need to get enough contributions down the roster. And I just think somebody's going to get it going. Whether it's, you know, like I'm sure you've heard some of these Denver fans clamoring for Russ to start over Jamal. I'm not sure that I would go that route. If for no reason, keep it the way it is.
I think it's working great in the current, you know, situation. Russ bringing that spark. I like it. I mean, look, I was wrong about Russ with Denver so far, at least so far. Playoffs, different story. We'll see. But Russ and Jokic are working great together.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I like that as a changeup too, where he can come in the game the way that he does. And most importantly, here's the thing. What happened when you won the title? When you won the title, Jamal Murray played like a superstar. That is your pathway. You need to get him back there by all means necessary, or by any means necessary. So like his rhythm, you might have to take some lumps with Jamal this year to make sure that he gets where he needs to get to by April.
When we're back, we're going to talk about the NBA Cup. All right, Jason, on Tuesday, the NBA Cup begins with the Magic at the Bucks and the Mavs at Thunder. Then on Wednesday, we have Hawks at Knicks, great rivalry matchup, and the Warriors at Rockets. The winners from those 4 games advance to Saturday for the semifinals in Vegas. And then next Tuesday, a week from today, the NBA Cup will take place in Las Vegas. So I have one question for you for every team in the NBA Cup. Let's go in order of the games here, starting with the Bucks. They've won 10 of 13 games. On last week's episode, I asked Yahoo's Dan Titus if they've gotten back to title contender status with this recent stretch. He said no. I say they're a tier or two below Boston, so they belong at least in the conversation. So same question for you. Do the Bucks now belong in the title conversation? Are they at that point now, Jason, after this 10 of 13 stretch?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, here's the thing. If you want to get like that detailed into the conversation, to me, Boston is on a tier by themselves. So if there's really only one championship contender, there's only one championship contender. I just think that's boring, and we got to talk about other championship contenders. So
plus injuries happen.
Absolutely.
Boston could have their 0-for-27 moment. Ankles can get turned. To me, conversation is a very vague term. It could mean 4 different teams belong in the conversation. Boston's the clear-cut favorite, but Cleveland belongs in the conversation. To me, New York belongs in the conversation, and Milwaukee belongs in the conversation when they have Giannis Antetokounmpo, who might be the MVP this season, Dame coming along. The rotation looks so much better at this point with Andre Jackson out there, AJ Green. Doc Rivers is really playing well right now as a head coach, like making decisions, pulling the right strings. I've been impressed by Doc. So to me, the belonging in the conversation, that's pretty broad.
Absolutely. To your point, I mean, we talked all year last year about Boston versus Denver, Boston versus Milwaukee, Boston versus Philly, and they never had to face any of them. So you could be one of those 29 teams that's like, well, what are we going to do if we get through Boston? And you might just get there and Boston might not be there. And then suddenly you have a chance to get the trophy. So I 100% agree with you. I do think this Bucks team is better than last year's team. I think Dame and Giannis are both better than they were last year. And again, the record might not reflect this because they got off to such a terrible start, but that's a whole other thing. And they were playing really bad basketball. They were even losing to bad teams during that stretch. It's kind of like it almost feels like so long ago, I don't even recognize that team. But like, Giannis, I think, is playing the best basketball of his career. I can't believe some of the stuff that he's doing. Him being able to pivot over his left shoulder and hit a little hook shot like consistently now has been something that's really unlocked him in the half court. Again, Dame has had some stinkers in there, but he's also had games where he's really carried them, so I'm not really concerned about that. AJ Green and Andre Jackson have provided pretty solid point of attack defense as of late for like 48 minutes. You're getting pretty decent contributions there. Torian Prince admirably filled his role, but Chris Middleton looked like Chris Middleton in the matchup against the Nets yesterday, and it's just good to have him back. I think both Brook and Giannis are playing the best defensive basketball they've played in a couple of years. I think they're very much a serious team at this point.
I mean, you mentioned Andre Jackson with his point of attack defense, the help defense as well. Like, he had a play, Dayron Sharp rolled to the rim, and then Jackson rotated. You saw this, right? Yeah. He rotated over to help, and he had the springs in his legs ready to leap vertically to contest the layup. But then Sharp kind of pump faked, hesitated, and Jackson just stayed down. And then when Sharp went up, Jackson sprung right up, completely altered the shot in a way that, like, a player, you know, much smaller, much lighter, should not be able to do, but he forced the miss. They get the ball, they score on the other end. And then a few minutes later, he had this just beautiful, mind-blowing chase down block
on Dorian Finney-Smith.
Yeah, it led to this weird, it led to this weird, annoying review that took way too long, but that's beside the point. But anyway, the point is, Andre Jackson made a big time shot alteration against Dayron Sharp, where it was just such a smart, high IQ play. Like, he just has such good feel as a help defender, and he's a great point of attack defender. Credit to Doc Rivers for a guy who notoriously over his career doesn't like to play young guys, giving a chance to Andre Jackson, giving a chance to AJ Green over Pat Connaughton. Those decisions have really worked out for the Bucks. I've been very impressed by what they've done. On the other side of that matchup on Tuesday, the Magic, sadly, very depressing, out without Franz Wagner. He's out indefinitely with a torn oblique. Same injury as Paolo Banchero. So not looking good for them in the NBA Cup. It looks like Jalen Suggs is going to be the guy who's going to have a much bigger offensive load. He had a much bigger shot diet on Sunday without Banchero, without Franz Wagner. Here's a stat for you, Jason, though. In 199 minutes this season with Suggs on the floor, without Franz Wagner, without Paolo Banchero, the Magic have a 98 offensive rating in those 199 minutes. That's a -9 net rating. Their defense stays elite, but their offense just goes down the drain. So they're going to need other guys to step up. So my question for you about the Magic is, who else needs to step up on the Orlando Magic for them to survive offensively?
I think it's mostly about leaning on their high floor, which comes from what they can do on defense. Like, you're still fast as can be on the perimeter. You're still a team that's big and physical and that can make teams work. Their schedule's pretty tough moving forward from here, but most of the games are at home. So I would lean on that energy and on that defensive effort to try to keep games close. And to your point, it's going to get ugly at stretches. I actually thought Jalen Suggs was pretty good yesterday.
He was really good.
I didn't, it's always funny. Every time a guy gets hurt, you see guys start to dig a little deeper into their bag and get a little more aggressive. And he had some like footwork and some pivots and some counters in the short to mid range yesterday where I was like, okay, Jalen, I didn't know you had that in your game there.
And he's a top five pick for good reason. Like, he showed these flashes at Gonzaga.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And he's just such an athletically imposing player at that position. But from there, it's like, you know, Anthony Black, he's been running some token second side action throughout the season. I think he's a guy that you'll see a lot more using a lot of like power game through guys like Mo Wagner. It's going to be a kind of a by committee sort of thing. Cole Anthony's going to get a lot of shots. It's going to be a lot of aggression from a lot of guys. But to me, the pathway is you're at home. I think they're on the road for the ISU. But after the in-season tournament, they're like, I want to say it's like four or five straight games at home, but they're all against good teams. It's like Miami and Boston and OKC and some like really good teams. So like, just drag these games down into the mud, make them ugly, make them physical. And yeah, you're not going to be scoring a ton of points, but give yourself a chance to win late. Maybe some guys make some shots.
I mean, hey, man, opportunity knocks. Maybe this ends up a blessing in disguise. Paolo goes out. Franz steps up, shows more layers to his game. Franz goes out now before Paolo Banchero comes back. Who knows? Maybe Jalen Suggs has a bunch of big games and suddenly becomes the clear-cut third offensive star. And who knows? Maybe this ends up a good thing for the Magic in the end. The other matchup on Tuesday night, we get the Oklahoma City Thunder hosting the Dallas Mavericks. OKC, it's been 1 month since Chet Holmgren got hurt. Since then, they're 10-3 with a number 5 offensive rating, the number 3 defensive rating. They're the only team in the NBA in the top 5 for both over this last month, number 1 in net rating. Jason, are the Thunder the West favorites, even if Chet Holmgren does not return?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, I think I'd go with yes. Because of the Hartenstein piece. Like, the Hartenstein thing is you know, the strength of this team.
He's so damn good, dude.
Oh, he's so good. They're starting to get, like, open on back cuts a lot now, which is something that, like, straight up wasn't a part of their offense in the past. The strength of the team, though, is perimeter speed and Jalen and Shea. That's what makes the Thunder so crazy is Chet was playing at like a top 15 level before he got hurt too. So like, there's this whole other like echelon of stuff to get into with the Thunder that we're not even going to get into. But like, the both Jalen and Shea are playing at an insanely high level. They both worked really hard in the early part of the season to add like pull up 3-point shooting to their games, and they're starting to see some of that come to fruition with these guys starting to knock down shots. Isaiah Hartenstein just gives him a big physical bruising front kind of aspect to the front line that wasn't there in the past. I think he's like the quintessential five out big in the league that can just flow from side to side, set good picks, score on the roll, but also reject screens and attack himself with the ball. He is like just constantly keeping things flowing from side to side. And I think it just kind of like helps on an offense, which, by the way, one of my biggest concerns with the Thunder in the big picture is like their willingness to work for the great shot instead of just the good shot. They kind of remind me of Boston a few years ago, where you still see the occasional, you know, just challenging a rim protector instead of making a swing pass, or like just taking some tougher shots early in the shot clock. So those are the things I keep an eye on with them. I would say that if Chet can't go, I think I would lean Dallas. But with Chet, though, I think they're a clear number one. That'll be my more controlled and calm response to your question.
I think that's a very fair response. I do. I mean, with Oklahoma City, what's so exciting about Hartenstein's success so far this year with the Thunder is like last year, understandably so, like you talk to Thunder fans and people around the Thunder, they're like, no, we're going to be five out all the time. But with Hartenstein, he is, as you said, quintessential 5 out 5, even though he isn't a shooter himself, because of the way he just connects and moves the ball and screens and finishes at the rim and causes gravity in that way. Like, he is elite in these intangible categories as a big without even needing to make threes. And so I think you think about adding Chet to that mix, the ability to now play with two high-level bigs, the lineup flexibility you have, the ability to be so flexible with your playing styles in order to adapt and dictate matchups, dictate the playing styles in the postseason. To me, that's what makes the Hartenstein, the Caruso additions so exciting for Oklahoma City. And we're already seeing the success of that with their defense is incredible. Caruso being part of that. And then Hartenstein offensively just adds a whole new dimension. So for OKC, I think that's spot on, Jason. The clear-cut favorites with Chet, probably number 2 or number 3 without him. That's what makes him so important. But we're seeing with Dallas early season, they were really not winning games. But, you know, the numbers-wise, offensive rating, defensive rating, they were better than their record indicated. Now that's finally starting to turn into wins. They've won 7 straight games entering this matchup against Oklahoma City on Tuesday. They have won 11 of 12 games. And this goes back to when Luka was out. Kyrie and the entire squad, Spencer Dinwiddie was stepping up, Najee Marshall was stepping up. In the 4 games since Luka got back, 31 points per game, 10.5 boards per game, 9.5 assists per game, shooting almost 43% from 3-point land. He's looking like an MVP guy again right now in the last 4 games. BetMGM has Dallas at plus 700 to win the NBA Cup. That's the 4th best odds. I think it's fair to have them there, considering they're on the road against Oklahoma City. They're underdogs on the road against OKC. Fair. However, considering what we saw them do on their finals run as underdogs, considering how amazing they've been in recent weeks, Jason, do you think at plus 700 to win the NBA Cup, the Mavs are the best value bet to win it all in the NBA Cup?
They're certainly the best value bet. I actually picked them to win it. That's what I have in my notes. I have Mavs over the Bucks to win it.
Bucks over Mavs. So we have the same finals.
I'm super high on Dallas, man. And like, it extends so far beyond even just basic stuff. Like Luka's awesome. It's I just think this is an awesome roster.
Yeah.
Like get 48 minutes of great center play. They have a bunch of different looks. They can go big, they can go small, they can go with five shooters. I was a little concerned about their perimeter speed coming into the season, but then they hit on Quentin Grimes and Spencer Dinwiddie, and now I'm not even worried about that anymore. Like, I feel like they've shown a willingness to just be like, hey, this is not a Klay Thompson game, so let's sit him down and let's go with somebody else. Like, they have so many different directions they can go. They have so many good basketball players. They've shown the ability to win when their stars go down, which makes me feel really good about them finishing with a top three seed. They've got a ton of experience. Again, the matchup flexibility to be able to attack certain types of teams that they'll meet along the way. I'm super, super high on Dallas right now, and I would absolutely consider them a value at plus 700 to win the Cup.
On Wednesday, the Knicks are going to be hosting the Hawks. Thinkingbasketball.net, Ben Taylor's great website. He obviously, everybody knows his YouTube channel. They have a bunch of stats on there. So that Thinking Basketball, they have offensive rating, very simple stuff, but against league average. The Knicks, 8.8 points better than the league average for offensive rating. That's number one in the NBA. Their defensive rating, though, is 1.4 points worse than the league average. Jason, do you think the Knicks defense can reach a point that they can seriously contend?
They have the personnel. I mean, like this has been like the biggest thing that stood out to me over the last couple of years covering the league is just how important it is to be fast and to be able to cover ground on the perimeter. How many defenders do you have that can credibly help and make things look congested and uncomfortable, but also chase guys off the 3-point line? How well are they, how well can they operate in rotation? Those kinds of situations, right? And like, to me, just a lot of guys have been underachieving. Like, Mikal Bridges just hasn't been guarding as well as he's capable of. You know, like the Josh Hart and OG Anunoby as well. They've been a little bit hesitant to switch as much as I think they're capable of too, which has made things a little harder on some of their guys. But I do think that, like I was talking about earlier with the Pelicans and Zion as it pertains to Cat, I think it's possible to put together a coherent defense based on perimeter play rather than just anchoring things at the rim. You just have to be really sharp there. And I think in a lot of ways, they're a victim of their own success in the sense that they've just been scoring like you wouldn't believe. Like, they everything that you would have dreamed about putting really good offensive players around Jalen Brunson and turning this into more of an equal opportunity offense has come to fruition, and putting a real pick and pop big next to him. All of that has worked so well that I don't think they've been incentivized to really polish things up on defense, but inevitably they're going to run into a stretch of games where the schedule kind of forces them to. I do think we'll see better defense out of the Knicks in the long run.
You know, you mentioned Jalen Brunson, the more equal opportunity offense, the pick and pop attack with Cat, and all that's been sensational. Number one offense in the NBA, it's been excellent. But another Thinking Basketball stat, Brunson, his time of possession, the percentage of time that he has the ball on his hands is 48%. That's number one in the NBA on thinkingbasketball.net.
Wait, 48% for the whole team? Are you serious? Yeah,
so he, when he's on the floor, he has the ball in his hands 48% of the time.
Wow.
So that is number one in the NBA. For reference, Luka is at 35%. So, like, that, just to put it into perspective with where another guy who has this reputation as having the ball in his hands all the time is, Chris Paul, 37%, SGA, 38%. So Brunson at 48% of the time that he's on the floor, the ball is in his hands. Is that sustainable? Because to me, it feels like too much. I know their offense is roaring right now, but I want to see a bit more Cat on the elbows facilitating. I want to see Bridges step up his game. Like, I want to see the ball in some other guy's hands more for the playoffs to feel like it's not just all on Brunson. It can't just be all on your little 6-foot guard to me, I think you need these other points of attack.
That's legitimately one of the crazier stats I've heard this year. That is, I wonder how much pace plays a role in that. But that's crazy. Because I tend to agree with you. Now, I think it's complicated in the sense that
you want to know who's number two. This is crazier. Do you want to take a guess? Who's number two?
I'm going to guess that it's either LaMelo Ball or LeBron James. Who is
it? No, it's Dennis Schroeder.
Dennis Schroeder.
Dennis Schroeder.
Hey, I like Dennis. I think Dennis can play.
47% of the time, the ball is in Dennis Schroeder's hand when he's on the floor.
That's crazy.
I know. It's crazy.
You know, I will say this, though. Like, they have a lot of guys that are like, and this is what I think is really smart in terms of like pairing stars with different types of players. And I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit when we get to the Warriors. But like, I think off-ball scoring complements on-ball scoring really well. And one of the things that I think is smart about the types of guys they've gone with is like Jalen Brunson does dribble the air out of the basketball. Jalen Brunson does have it in his hands all the time. So if you get guys like, to me, Mikhail, OG, and Kat are all like off-ball scorers. They're guys who are really gifted at scoring when you give them an advantage. But yeah, like there are some limitations when you ask them to initiate things. And so I think part of maybe a potential counter there is to come up with like simple pet actions where Jalen Brunson is maybe setting things up, but it's like early in the possession where he gets rid of the ball and someone looks to attack right away so that at least other people are getting into a rhythm, to your point. But to your point, it's hard to micromanage an offense that's lighting the world on fire.
I know exactly. It is. And on the other side of that, we have Trae Young and the Hawks going into New York. I'm sure the fans will be very nice to him on Tuesday night. Trae Young third, by the way, and possession time at 46%. Trae's had an interesting year because in some ways I watch Trae and I'm in love with what I'm seeing. He had his 20 assist game. He's 12.2 assists on the year, but he's shooting only 31% from three. He's below 40% from the field. He's taking only 16.7 shots per game. That's a career low since his rookie season. What are your thoughts on this evolution of Trae Young with him passing more, shooting less efficiently, but still having that dynamic playmaking ability? Is this the best Trae we've ever seen? Or do you feel like there's been a decline? What are your thoughts on this evolution of Trae Young, Jason?
I think it's the Trae Young that this particular roster needs. This team actually reminds me a lot of the Clippers in the sense that you lose a second star, right? Obviously, DeJounte Murray, Kawhi Leonard, you know, very different types of players, but same general idea. But like the roster build that has been left over is pretty similar in the sense you look at the Clippers and it's like James Harden and Ivica Zubac. It's like kind of match made in heaven for ball screens. And then just athlete, 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 athlete. Every athlete just runs and jumps as well as everybody else does and can do some basic rudimentary, like, you know, shooting and driving a closeout, stuff like that. In Atlanta, it's the same thing. It's like you have Trae Young, you have Clint Capella, the same kind of like pick and roll duo that's got all this chemistry over the years. And then it's just athlete, 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 dudes who run the floor. And like, it's almost the perfect fit with Trae in the sense that like, you know how it is with Trae compared to like the rudimentary playmakers in the league where like Trae's really good at like kick ahead passes, lob passes, hitting cutters along the baseline. So it's actually like a really perfect fit to have him as like this passing fulcrum around all these athletes. And similarly to James Harden, on a team that is lacking offensive skill, that is going to rely on him to take a lot of iffy shots, James's efficiency has gone down a little bit, but the team has been playing pretty well. And that's kind of the way I look at it with the Hawks, where it's like, yeah, his efficiency is down a little bit, but this is a bunch of defensive-minded athletes and a bunch of guys who capitalize on everything that Trae does. And so even though his efficiency is down, the Hawks have looked feistier just because they, in terms of overall aggregate impact on both ends, they're actually better than they were last year.
I think that's spot on. Trae is giving the team what they need. I felt that way last season. Last season, I thought was the best version of Trae that I had ever seen. It began to solve some of the criticisms I've had in the past with off-ball movement, defensive effort, and intensity. That got better. That has continued into this year, but this year is a little bit different because they need more from him as the creator with DeJounte Murray not there anymore and all these young guys who need a guy to create easy shots for them, and that's what he's doing. and they're playing feisty basketball. I like watching the Hawks this year, and Trae Young's a big reason for that. That 31-point game-winning shot he had against the Lakers with the 20 assists, that was an awesome game. Trae has been great, and despite, I think, the numbers, those should improve over the course of the season. I don't love the Hawks' chances in the NBA Cup, but, I mean, who knows? Maybe they have an upset against the Knicks and win a couple games. We'll see there. The last game on Wednesday is the Rockets and the Warriors. Got a mailbag question here that I thought we'd tie to this Rockets team from Jono. And he pointed out in the mailbag that the top three teams in the West are the Thunder, the Grizzlies, and the Rockets. And he wrote, none of these teams have old-ass stars or old dudes playing big minutes. Same thing in the East. Cavs, Celtics, Magic, all younger groups. And he points out that all these teams, or especially in the West, they don't have these old dudes who need to sit. They don't have these guys to load manage. And he writes, it's the new trend in the NBA. Get a pool of young talent and you win. The golden guys are dead. Do you think John was right that, and do you think in the context of Houston that this is kind of the formula for their success? Just put together a bunch of hardworking, gritty, energetic young guys, and it leads to regular season success. Is that part of what we're seeing with Houston and these other teams this year?
Absolutely, to with respect to the regular season. I don't think it's a coincidence either that like both of those, like all three of those teams have like really good perimeter defenders that are physical and can pressure the ball. Memphis is a little tricky because it's some of their guys come off the bench, but like even Desmond Bane, like he sits in a stance and he's physical and he'll pressure the ball. He'll fight you off of spots and make you uncomfortable. They have just waves and waves of young athletes that cover ground on the perimeter. Like Houston is a big ball pressure team. OKC is a big ball pressure team. So I think that's a big part of it. I think that in an ideal world, you'd have both. This is why like the basketball fan, like even though I know this will never happen, I'd love to see LeBron with Golden State. Because like I just imagine old ass LeBron with a ton of young dudes who run really well. Versus what Rob Pelinka has chosen to do and put old ass LeBron alongside a bunch of dudes who don't like to run and how that can be a problem. Right. But like, I think that's the biggest piece is just the overall, just the speed and the way that kind of drives things. But like specifically with Houston, I've always just looked at them as a team that depends entirely on whether or not Jalen Green and Fred VanVleet can create shots. And they're just both so inconsistent. Like they both have good games and bad games and everything in between. And it just kind of feels like what's going to happen tonight. And it's like when they lost to Golden State, it's like Jalen Green and Fred VanVleet were both terrible and they couldn't score. You know what I mean? But then like on any given night, maybe Jalen Green goes for 40. Maybe Fred VanVleet goes for 38. And when one of those guys has a really good offensive game and they defend the way they're capable of, they can beat anybody. But then that's what the old guys do. The old 32-year-old offensive engine dude, he's going to be more consistently good offensively when you get into big games late in the season. So again, that's why you want ideally both, and that's why Boston's better than all these teams, and that's why I'm so high on Dallas, because Dallas to me is a team that has kind of both, if that makes sense.
I think that's a very fair point. Houston, great regular season success, maybe even great NBA Cup success. We'll see, because the playoffs are a far different monster when you're talking about a seven-game series. But one game, single elimination, who knows what can happen. Amen Thompson, Tari Eason, those guys could be completely dominant defensively, creating transition opportunities against Golden State. They win first round and move on to Vegas. Who knows? With the Warriors, there was news over the weekend. Last Friday, Draymond Green moved to the bench. Jonathan Kuminga moved to the starting lineup. Sunday, that was different because Wiggins was out. But, you know, this seems to be what's going to happen moving forward, Jason. Draymond Green coming off the bench. Kuminga starting games. Is this happening solely to pump Kuminga's trade value? I believe that's the case. What do you think?
That's exactly what it is. Because like,
that's it. No other reason. So, that's the sole reason. No other reason.
I think it's the sole reason because like, it is a public dump. This is they're holding him out their Simba style for somebody.
Yes, a pump and dump Jonathan Kuminga. That's what it is. Yes,
it's you can see how you're thinking in terms of what they need, which is they desperately need a front court player that can consistently give them 20 points a game efficiently. Like that's what they desperately need, in my opinion. And if that was what they actually needed, Wiggins is just a better option for that right now, because like Wiggins can do it more within the flow of their offense, where it feels like Kuminga's a little more ball stoppy, a little bit more of like a guy where things have to be kind of catered for him to go off offensively. And like in theory, over the last four games, Kuminga's averaging 20 points and he's been kind of efficient. But it's like if you dig a little deeper, it's like the one game when Steph was out, he had 30 something, and then he's been really uneven in the other games. And so like I think it's strictly just an attempt to try to drive up his scoring volume and efficiency, put together like a solid 2-week run where he's averaging 23, 24 points a game, and then maybe you can move him. I'm convinced that's what it is.
I think so too. I mean, and as it should be, it makes total sense. You put him on display for teams around the league to say, oh, that's what he could do for us. It is fair. Like it gives a vision for what a team can see, proof of concept of what he could look like for your franchise, can increase your confidence in a trade. Now, whether something that pops up that makes sense for the Warriors, we'll end up seeing if that actually happens. But for now, this happening during the NBA Cup, Draymond's still going to be closing games. He's been defensive player of the year, quality level player. I had him in my top three when I did my ballot last month. He'll probably still be in the top three when I do it again later this month. But Warriors, you know, I think we're going to see Warriors Dallas in that second round on Saturday. You mentioned you have Dallas over Bucks winning it all. I said I have the Bucks over the Mavericks winning it all. Are you excited for this, the NBA Cup, or are you just like, eh? Whatever, because I loved it last year. I had a great time watching the games.
I'll take it a step further. I love it, and I think it's really lame when people complain about it. I'm like, dude, what's wrong with you? Why? Like, how could you not like this? It's basketball. It's stakes. Like, I don't understand the people who hate on it.
Well, on the topic of Vegas, last thing we'll talk about today, Jason, you and I have both spent a lot of time at Sphere. I was there opening night for U2. I was there for Dead & Company. I saw the Sphere Experience. I saw the Eagles as well. And to me, it's the best concert venue in the world. There's nothing like it. Tell me about your time at Sphere seeing Dead & Company. Was that your first time at Sphere as well?
Yeah, so I was originally only planning on going once. I went with some family over the right before Summer League started that Thursday. And then I was like, well, I got to go back. So I went back on Saturday.
Because you're a real deadhead as well, right? Like you're a legit deadhead. Yes.
Yeah. My parents raised me on it. And then ever since John Mayer took over, I'm just like completely invested. But like, I had to take my wife because like I've like, you have to see this. This is like an incredible experience. And like it's funny because I, at the risk of doing a terrible job, I always tell myself I'm never going to try to explain it because it just pales in comparison. Mm-hmm. But at its base, it's just a very good venue experience. Like the line to get in, very smooth. The concession lines, very smooth.
A-plus.
The bathroom lines,
the
very
best
smooth.
Concessions I have ever been to at any arena.
Easily.
The best.
Easily.
Yes.
You're never waiting for anything. The temperature in the venue is perfect.
Yes.
The seats are incredibly comfortable and spaced out the right amount. Like, so that's step one. And then I'll also throw in the acoustics are by far the best. Like, dude, I saw Dead & Company at Oracle Park for their final show and the final tour, you know, the final tour before they did two more tours. So, and I was sitting in seats, beautiful view of the bay, like just an unbelievable experience. And the sound quality sucked. And I was like, this is kind of ruining it for me. And like, even when I sat at amphitheaters, like, you know, that are meant for music, it just nothing to me compares to that like perfect acoustic surround vibe that you get at the Sphere. And none of that even comes close to the fact that the visual experience is like unlike anything you've ever seen. And beyond the actual digital displays, like even just something simple like having the artist on the screen with perfect real-time crisp imagery to put everything together, it's just a 10 out of 10 experience, man. And you know better than anybody because you've seen more people there.
I mean, dude, it really is remarkable. The sound, it's like they have this innovative sound technology that beams the sound waves to individual seats. So it's like replicating the experience of having like a good speaker system in your room. like high quality speakers next to you. That's what it's like, except they're not. They're very far away and the sound waves are being beamed to your seats. And it's amazing. Like you mentioned the visual aspect. I brought my mom there this summer. It was one of the last things we did as like a little summer trip. We drove to Zion National Park in Utah, which was gorgeous. And then on the way back, we made a pit stop in Vegas and I surprised her and said, hey, I'm going to take you to Sphere. And she's like, oh, wow, I never thought I'd get to go here. And so, because she knows how I've always raved about it. And so, like, she, like, talks about it all the time now because same thing you said. You talk about it, you sit, you feel like you can try to do a little bit of justice to it. You can show videos to your friends and all that. It doesn't compare. And that's what she said. She's like, when you go there, then you get it. With the sound, with the video, the visuals. And she didn't even see a concert. She saw the hour-long movie they do, Sphere Experience, was that thing which cool? is very cool. It's cool. Yeah, I've seen it twice. Like, if you can't see a show, I'd recommend, you know, going to that to anybody who wants to check it out. It's cool. It gives you the idea and it's beautiful. Like, you know, the visuals and you get to experience the audio and all that. But nothing matches a concert, in my opinion. But it's very cool. But yeah, like she says the same thing as you, where it's like, you're like, all the things you said to me and showed me, it doesn't do it justice because it can't. And to me, like, it's the sound, the visuals, the experience there. It is without a doubt the best concert venue in the world. The reason why I wanted to bring it up with you today is A, Vegas, but B, Dead & Company. They're back.
They're back, man. They're back. I'm so excited. Dude, I was literally saying to my wife, I was like, after the last show that we went to last year, because I actually missed one too. I had a flight get delayed for a storm, and I was supposed to go to 4 shows last year, and I only went to 3.
Oh wow, so you went to, like, only 3? Wow,
only 3. But yeah, when it was done, I told Carly, I was like, I hope they're not done because they're playing too well right now. Like, it just, like, they are peaking as a band right now, and they've added enough young talent to kind of keep even the older guys invigorated. And John, to me, watching John is like watching LeBron or Michael in his prime.
I agree.
He gives a great show every single night. Mm-hmm. He takes a personal responsibility in providing a show. Mm-hmm. I think he's one of the most gifted musicians ever, personally. And that doesn't even account for the fact that he's like a pop star.
Multiple decades now, of 20, yeah. 25 years, he's been a pop star. So, like, John Mayer doesn't have to do Grateful Dead. Like, he doesn't have to, but he's been doing it
just
for
the love of the
now?
Game, Kevin.
Exactly. Love of the game. And he's like, he's keeping the music on for a whole new generation. Cause I'm not a Deadhead, but John Mayer looped me in and introduced me to the Grateful Dead. And I've become a fan. Like, I've listened to more Grateful Dead in the past year than I ever had combined in years past after seeing them live. So yeah, John Mayer, a true legend. He really
true
is.
Legend.
And he can play and talk about, you know, tie this to basketball. You mentioned they brought in young talent. You need that balance. And that's what this band has right now. And John Mayer, a star who never stopped getting better.
Oh,
John
my
goodness,
Mayer, man.
Continuing to add layers to his game over the years. What a talent.
Oh, man. I watched him play a show without his left index finger. And
oh,
like,
you were there that weekend.
Yeah.
Oh, my
and
God.
Like,
unbelievable.
I was like, I couldn't believe it. It was like, here's the thing.
And you're a guitarist, too.
You know
how tough that is to do.
Yeah. Like, oh, if I lost my left index finger, it's over. Like, there's nothing I could do. But like, like it was imperceptible, the drop off. It was imperceptible. I was so impressed. I was so impressed. Like I don't even know. Like, even just from, like, I was less concerned about the solos, and I was more concerned. Like, I was thinking, like, how do you play the songs when you can't work through the chord progressions when you're missing your index finger? And it's imperceptible. You can't tell the difference. Like, it was mm-hmm. it was legitimately crazy. I can't say enough about the guy. I think he's the best guitarist ever. But I feel like I'm too young to make that opinion. So it is what it is.
I think it's fair to say he's one of the greatest guitarists ever when you consider the songwriting ability, the acoustic playing ability, the mm-hmm. soloing ability. It's just, the versatility is unmatched, the career longevity, and he's still going. He's still releasing great music, and he's still playing with Dead & Company, and he's still getting better. John Mayer, legend, elite of the elite. I think he's fair to be your GOAT.
Yes, he's the GOAT. I agree.
Jason, maybe we'll see each other at one of those Dead & Company shows next year. It's happening during March Madness and during the NBA playoffs. It's tough timing. I think one of those March Madness weekends is possible. I might be able to pull that off, but NBA playoffs not happening.
I was telling Kevin in a text message, like, Dead & Company is an improvisational band. The first time they play together every year, it gets a little sloppy. So I recommend going second weekend. So that's what I'm going to be going. That second weekend in March is when I'll be like there.
Sweet 16, Elite 8. Might have to miss one game live. That's okay. Can catch up on the following morning. Can't watch everything live. Jason, where can we find your stuff?
So on YouTube at Hoops Tonight, wherever you get your podcasts, Hoops Tonight, on Twitter at _JasonLT. I do like film stuff there sometimes. But yeah, it was just daily NBA reaction, just like Kevin does.
Jason, one of the best covering the NBA. Hoops Tonight, almost every single night. I mean, you are live all the time, it feels like. You do great stuff with the volume. Jason, appreciate you joining me on the show today.
Kevin, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time, and it was really fun to come talk some hoops with you today.
Big fan of you, Jason. Thank you for joining the show. Thank you to Stone for producing the Kevin O'Connor Show. Please subscribe if you have not done so already. It really does help us out. And please have a great rest of your week. Enjoy the NBA Cup. We'll be back again on Friday.